During battle, for instance, a commander can relay simple information and commands directly to those officers under him, if those officers have been trained to receive it. One powerfully skilled can use his talent to influence even untrained minds or the minds of his enemies, inspiring them with fear or confusion or doubt. Men so talented are rare, but if incredibly gifted with the skill, a man can aspire to speak directly to the elderlings, those who are below only the gods themselves. Few have ever dared to do so, and of those who did, even fewer attained what they asked. For it is said, one may ask of the elderlings, but what they answer may not be the question you ask, but the one you should have asked. And the answer to that question may be one a man cannot hear and live. For when one speaks to the elderlings, then is the sweetness of using the skill strongest and most perilous, and this is the thing that every practitioner of the skill, weak or strong, must always guard against. For in using the skill, the user feels a keenness of life, an uplifting of being, that can distract a man from taking his next breath. Compelling is this feeling, even in the most common uses of the skill, and addictive to any not hardened of purpose. But the intensity of this exaltation when speaking to the elderlings is a thing for which we have no comparison. Both senses and sense may be blasted forever from a man who uses the skill to speak to an elderling. Such a man dies raving. But it is also true, he dies raving of his joy.
The fool was right. I had no idea of the peril I faced. I plunged on doggedly. I have no heart to detail the weeks that followed. Suffice to say that with each day Galen had us more under his sway, and that he also became more cruel and manipulative. Some few pupils disappeared early on. Mary was one. She stopped coming after the fourth day. I saw her only once after that, creeping about the keep with a face both woe-begone and shamed. I learned later that Serene and the other women had shunned her after she had dropped the training, and when they later spoke of her, it was not as if she had failed at a test, but rather had committed some low and loathsome act for which she could never be forgiven.
I know not where she went, only that she left Buck Keep, and never returned.
As the ocean sorts pebbles from sand on a beach and stratifies them at the tide mark, so did the poundings and caressings of Galen separate his students. Initially, all of us strove to be his best. It was not because we liked or admired him. I know not what the others felt, but in my heart was nothing but hate for him. But it was a hatred so strong that it spawned a resolution not to be broken by such a man. After days of his abuse, to wring a single grudging word of acknowledgement from him was like a torrent of praise from any other master. Days of his belittling should have made me numb to his mockery. Instead, I came to believe much of what he said, and tried futilely to change. We vied constantly with one another to come to his attention. Some emerged clearly as his favorites. August was one, and we were often exhorted to imitate him. I was clearly his most despised, and yet this did not stop me from burning to distinguish myself before him. After the first time, I was never last on the tower top. I never wavered from his blows, nor did Serene, who shared my distinction of being despised. Serene became Galen's grovelling follower, never breathing a word of criticism about him after that first lashing. Yet he constantly found fault with her, berated and reviled her, and struck her far more often than he struck any of the other women. Yet it made her only more determined to prove that she could withstand his abuse, and she, after Galen, was the most intolerant of any who wavered or doubted in our teaching. Winter deepened. It was cold and dark on the tower top, save for what light came from the stairwell. It was the most isolated place in the world, and Galen was god of it. He forged us into a unit. We believed ourselves elite, superior, and privileged to be instructed in the skill. Even I, who endured mockery and beatings, believed this to be so. Those of us he broke, we despised. We saw only one another for this time. We heard only Galen. At first, I missed Chade. I wondered what Burrich and Lady Patience were doing. But as months went by, such lesser occupations no longer seemed interesting. Even the fool and smithy came to be almost annoyances to me. So single-mindedly did I pursue Galen's approval. The fool came and went silently then, though there were times when I was sorest and weariest, when the touch of Smithy's nose against my cheek was the only comfort I had, and times when I felt shamed by how little time I was giving to my growing puppy. After 3 months of cold and cruelty, Galen had whittled us down to 8 candidates. The real training finally began, and also he returned to us a small measure of comfort and dignity. These seemed by then not only great luxuries, but gifts from Galen to be grateful for. A bit of dried fruit with our meals, permission to wear shoes, brief conversation allowed at the table, that was all. And yet, we were grovelingly grateful for it. But the changes were only beginning. It comes back in crystal glimpses. I remember the first time he touched me with the skill. We were on the tower top, spaced even farther now that there were fewer of us. He paused a moment before each, while the rest of us watched in reverent silence.
Ready your minds for the touch. Be open to it, but do not indulge in the pleasure of it. The purpose of the skill is not pleasure.
He wended his way among us, in no particular order. Spaced as we were, we could not see one another's faces, nor did it ever please Galen that our eyes followed his movements. And so we heard only his brief, stern words, and heard the indrawn gasp of each touched one. To Serene he said in disgust,
"Be open to it," I said, "not cower like a beaten dog."
And last he came to me. I listened to his words, and as he had counseled us earlier, I tried to let go of every sensory awareness I had, and be open only to him. I felt the brush of his mind against mine, like a soft tickle on my forehead. I stood firm before it. It grew stronger, a warmth, a light. But I refused to be drawn into it. I felt Galen stood within my mind, sternly regarding me, and using the focusing techniques he had taught us.
"Imagine a pail of purest white wool, and pour yourself into it."
I was able to stand before him, waiting, aware of the skill's elation, but not giving in to it. Thrice the warmth rushed through me, and thrice I stood before it. And then he withdrew. He gave me a grudging nod, but in his eyes I saw not approval, but a trace of fear. That first touch was like the spark that finally kindles the tinder. I grasped what it was. I could not do it yet. I could not send my thoughts out from me. But I had a knowing that would not fit into words. I would be able to skill. And with that knowing, my resolve hardened, and there was nothing, nothing Galen could have done that would stop me learning it. I think he knew it. For some reason it frightened him, for he turned on me in the days that followed with a cruelty that I now find incredible. Hard words and blows he dealt me, but none could turn me aside. He struck me once in the face with his quirt. It left a visible welt, and it chanced that when I was coming into the dining hall, Burrich was also there. I saw his eyes widen. He started up from his place at table, his jaw clenched in a way I knew too well. But I looked aside from him, and down. He stood a moment glaring at Galen, who returned his look with a supercilious stare. Then, fists clenched, Burrich turned his back and left the room. I relaxed, relieved there would be no confrontation. But then Galen looked at me, and the triumph in his face made my heart cold. I was his now, and he knew it. Pain and victories mixed for me in the next week. He never lost an opportunity to belittle me, and yet I knew I excelled at each exercise he gave us. I sensed the others groping after his touch of skill, but for me it was as simple as opening my eyes. I knew one moment of intense fear. He had entered my mind with the skill, and given me a sentence to repeat aloud. "I am a bastard, and I shame my father's name," I said aloud, calmly. And then he spoke again within my mind.
"You draw the strength from somewhere, bastard. This is not your skill. Do you think I will not find the source?"
And then I quailed before him and drew back from his touch, hiding Smithy within my mind. His smile showed all his teeth to me. In the days that followed, we played a game of hide-and-seek. I must let him into my mind to learn the skill. Once there, I danced on coals to keep my secrets from him. Not just Smithy, but Chade and the Fool did I hide, and Molly and Carrie and Dirk, and other older secrets I would not reveal even to myself. He sought them all, and I juggled them desperately out of his reach, but despite all that, or perhaps because of it, I felt myself growing stronger in the skill.
"Don't mock me!"
he roared after one session, and then grew infuriated as the other students exchanged shocked glances.
"Attend to your own exercises!"
he roared at them. He paced away from me, then spun suddenly and flung himself at me. Fist and boot, he attacked me, and as Molly once had, I had no more thought than to shield my face and belly. The blows he rained on me were more like a child's tantrum than a man's attack. I felt their ineffectiveness, and then realized with a chill that I was repelling at him. Not so much that he would sense it, just enough that not one of his blows fell exactly as he had intended. I knew more, that he had no idea what I was doing. When at last he dropped his fists and I dared to lift my eyes, I felt momentarily I had won, for all the others on the tower top were looking at him with gazes mingled of disgust and fear. He had gone too far for even Serene to stomach. White-faced, he turned aside from me. In that moment, I felt him reach a decision. That evening in my room I was horribly tired, but too enervated to sleep. The Fool had left food for Smithy, and I was teasing him with a large beef knuckle. He had set his teeth in my sleeve and was worrying it, while I held the bone just out of his reach. It was the sort of game he loved, and he snarled with mock ferocity as he shook my arm. He was near as big as he would get, and I felt with pride the muscles in his thick little neck. With my free hand, I pinched his tail, and he spun snarling to this new attack. From hand to hand I juggled his bone, and his eyes darted back and forth as he snapped after it. "No brain," I teased him. "All you can think of is what you want. No brain, no brain."
"Just like his owner,"
I startled. And in that second Smithy had his bone. He flopped down with it, giving the Fool no more than a perfunctory wag of his tail. I sat down, out of breath. I never even heard the door open. Or shut. He ignored that, and went straight to his topic.
"Do you think Galen will allow you to succeed?"
I grinned smugly. "Do you think he can prevent it?" The Fool sat down beside me with a sigh.
"I know he can. So does he. What I cannot decide is if he is ruthless enough, but I suspect he is."
"So let him try," I said flippantly.
"I have no choice in that."
The Fool was adamantly serious.
"What I had hoped to do was dissuade you from trying."
"You'd ask me to give up, now?" I was incredulous.
"I would."
"Why?" I demanded.
"Because,"
he began, and then stopped in frustration.
"I don't know. Too many things converge. Perhaps if I pluck one thread loose, the knot will not form."
I was suddenly tired, and the earlier elation of my triumph collapsed before his dour warnings. My irritability won, and I snapped, "If you cannot speak clearly, why do you speak at all?" He was as silent as if I had struck him.
"That's another thing I don't know," he said at last.
He rose to go. "Fool," I began.
"Yes, I am that,"
he said, and left. And so I persevered, growing stronger. I grew impatient with our slow pace of instruction. We went over the same practices each day, and gradually the others began to master what seemed so natural to me. How could they have been so closed off from the rest of the world, I wondered? How could it be so hard for them to open their minds to Galen's skill? My own task was not to open, but rather to keep closed to him what I did not wish to share. Often, as he gave me a perfunctory touch of the skill, I sensed a tendril of seeking slinking into my mind. But I evaded it.
"You are ready,"
he announced one chill day. It was afternoon, but the brightest stars were already showing in the blue darkness of the sky. I missed the clouds that had yesterday snowed upon us, but had at least kept this deeper cold at bay. I flexed my toes inside the leather shoes that Galen permitted us, trying to warm them to life again.
"Before, I have touched you with the skill to accustom you to it. Now, today, we will attempt a full joining. You will each reach out to me as I reach out to you, but beware. Most of you have coped with resisting the distractions of the skill touch, but the power of what you felt was the lightest brush. Today will be stronger. Resist it, but stay open to the skill."
And again, he began his slow circuit among us. I waited, enervated, but unafraid. I had looked forward to attempting this. I was ready. Some clearly failed, and were rebuked for laziness or stupidity. August was praised. Serene was slapped for reaching forth too eagerly. And then he came to me. I braced as if for a wrestling contest. I felt the brush of his mind against mine, and offered him a cautious reaching of thought. "Like this?"
"Yes, bastard.
Like this."
And for a moment we were in balance, hovering like children on a seesaw. I felt him steady our contact, then, abruptly, he slammed into me. It felt exactly as if the air had been knocked out of me, but in a mental rather than physical way. Instead of being able to get my breath, I was unable to master my thoughts. He rifled through my mind, ransacking my privacy, and I was powerless before him. He had won, and he knew it. But in that moment of his careless triumph, I found an opening. I grasped at him, trying to seize his mind as he had mine. I gripped him and held him, and knew for a dizzying instant that I was stronger than he, that I could force into his mind any thought I chose to put there.
"No!"
he shrieked. And dimly I knew that, at some former time, he had struggled like this with someone he had despised, someone else who had also won, as I intended to.
"Yes,"
I insisted.
"Die!"
he commanded me. But I knew I would not. I knew I would win, and I focused my will and bore down on my grip. The skill does not care who wins. It does not allow anyone to surrender to any one thought, even for a moment. But I did. And when I did, I forgot to guard against the ecstasy that is both the honey and the sting of the skill. The euphoria rushed over me, drowning me, and Galen too sank below it, no longer exploring my mind, but only seeking to return to his. I had never felt the like of that moment. Galen had called it pleasure, and I had expected a pleasant sensation, like warmth in winter, or the fragrance of a rose, or a sweet taste in my mouth. This was none of these. Pleasure is too physical a word to describe what I felt. It had nothing to do with the skin or body. It suffused me, it washed over me in a wave that I could not repulse. Elation filled me, and flowed through me. I forgot Galen and all else. I felt him escape me, and knew it mattered, but could not care. I forgot all except exploring this sensation.
bastard!
Galen bellowed, and struck me with his fist on the side of my head. I fell helpless, for the pain was not enough to jolt me from the entrancement of the skill. I felt him kick me. I knew the cold of the stones under me that bruised and scraped me, and yet I felt I was held, smothered, in a blanket of euphoria that would not let me pay attention to the beating. My mind assured me, despite the pain, that all was well. There was no need to fight or flee. Somewhere a tide was ebbing, leaving me beached and gasping. Galen stood over me, disheveled and sweating. His breath smoked in the cold air as he leaned close over me.
Die!
He said. But I did not hear the words. I felt them. He let go of my throat, and I fell. And in the wake of the devouring elation of the skill, came now a bleakness of failure and guilt that made my physical pain as nothing. My nose was bleeding, it was painful to breathe, and the force of the kicks he had dealt me had scraped skin from my body as I had slid across the tower stones. The different pains so contradicted one another, each clamoring for attention, that I couldn't even assess what damage had been done to me. I could not even gather myself together to stand back up, but looming over all was the knowledge that I had failed. I was defeated and unworthy, and Galen had proved it. As if from a distance, I heard him shouting at the others, telling them to beware, for this was how he would deal with those so undisciplined that they could not turn their minds from pleasure to the skill. And he warned them all of what befell such a man who strove to use the skill, and instead fell under the spell of the pleasure of it, bore with it. Such a man would become mindless, a great infant, speechless, sightless, soiling himself, forgetting thought, forgetting even food and drink until he died. Such a one was beyond disgust. And such a one was I. I sank into my shame, helplessly I began to sob. I merited such treatment as he had given me. I deserved worse. Only a misplaced pity had kept Galen from killing me. I had wasted his time, had taken his painstaking instruction, and turned it all to selfish indulgence. I fled myself, going deeper and deeper within, but finding only disgust and hatred for myself layered throughout my thoughts. I would be better off dead. Were I to throw myself from the tower roof, it would still not be enough to destroy my shame, but at least I need no longer be aware of it. I lay still and wept. The others left. As each one passed, they had a word, a gobbet of spittle, a kick, or a blow for me. I scarcely noticed. I rejected myself more completely than they could. Then they were gone, and Galen stood over me. He nudged me with his foot, but I was incapable of response. Suddenly he was everywhere, over, under, around, and inside me, and I could not deny him.
"You see, bastard,"
he said archly, calmly.
"I tried to tell them you were not worthy. I tried to tell them the training would kill you. But you would not listen. You strove to usurp that which had been given to another. Again, I am right. Well, this has not been time wasted, if it has done away with you."
I don't know when he left me. After a time, I was aware that it was the moon looking down on me, and not Galen. I rolled onto my belly. I could not stand, but I could crawl. Not quickly, not even lifting my stomach completely off the ground, but I could scuffle and scrape myself along. With a singleness of purpose, I began to make my way toward the low wall. I thought that I could drag myself up onto a bench, and from there to the top of the wall, and from there, down. End it. It was a long journey, in the cold and the dark. Somewhere I could hear a whimpering, and I despised myself for that, too. But as I scraped myself along, it grew, as a spark in the distance becomes a fire as one approaches. It refused to be ignored. It grew louder in my mind, a whining against my fate, a tiny voice of resistance that forbade that I should die, that denied my failure. It was warmth and light, too, and it grew stronger and stronger as I tried to find its source. I stopped. I lay still. It was inside me. The more I sought it, the stronger it grew. It loved me. Loved me even if I couldn't, wouldn't, didn't love myself. Loved me even if I hated it. It set its tiny teeth in my soul and braced and held so that I couldn't crawl any farther. And when I tried, a howl of despair burst from it, searing me, forbidding me to break so sacred a trust. It was Smithy. He cried with my pains, physical and mental. And when I stopped struggling toward the wall, he went into a paroxysm of joy, a celebration of triumph for us. And all I could do to reward him was to lie still and no longer attempt to destroy myself. And he assured me it was enough. It was a plenitude. It was a joy. I closed my eyes. The moon was high when Burrich rolled me gently over. The fool held high a torch, and Smithy capered and danced about his feet. Burrich gathered me up and stood, as if I was still a child just given into his care. I had a glimpse of his dark face, but read nothing there. He carried me down the long stone staircase, and the fool bore the torch to light the way. And he took me out of the keep, and back to the stables, and up to his room. There the fool left Burrich and Smithy and me, and I do not recall that there had been one word spoken. Burrich set me down on his own bed, and then dragged it, bedstead and all, closer to the fire. With returning warmth came great pain, and I gave my body over to Burrich, my soul to Smithy, and let go of my mind for a long while. I opened my eyes to the night. I knew not which one. Burrich sat next to me still, undozing, not even slumped in his chair. I felt the strictures of bandaging on my ribs. I lifted a hand to touch it, but was baffled by two splinted fingers. Burrich's eyes followed my motion. They were swollen with more than cold. Too swollen for me to tell if they were breaks or just sprains. I splinted them in case. I suspect they are just sprained. I think if they were broken, the pain of my working on them would have wakened even you. He spoke calmly, as if telling me that he had purged a new dog for worms as a preventative against contagion. And just as his steady voice and calm touch had worked on a frantic animal, so it worked on me. I relaxed, thinking that if he were calm, not much could be wrong. He slipped a finger under the bandages supporting my ribs, checking the tightness. "What happened?" he asked, and turned aside from me to pick up a cup of tea as he spoke, as if the question and my answer were of no great import. I pushed my mind back over the last few weeks, tried to find a way to explain. Events danced in my mind, slipped away from me. I remembered only defeat. "Galen tested me," I said slowly. "I failed. And he punished me for it." And with my words, a wave of dejection, shame, and guilt swept over me, washing away the brief comfort I had taken in the familiar surroundings. On the hearth, a sleeping Smithy abruptly waked and sat up. Reflexively, I quieted him before he could whine. "Lay down. Rest. It's all right." To my relief, he did so. And to my great relief, Burrich seemed unaware of what had passed between us. He offered me the cup. "Drink this. You need water in you, and the herbs will deaden the pain and let you sleep. Drink it all now." "It stinks," I told him, and he nodded and held the cup my hands were too bruised to curl around. I drank it all, and then lay back. "That was all?" he asked carefully, and I knew to what he referred. "He tested you on a thing he had taught you, and you did not know it.
So he did this to you?
I could not do it. I didn't have the self-discipline, so he punished me.
Details eluded me. Shame washed over me, drowning me in misery.
No one is taught self-discipline by beating him after death.
Burrich spoke carefully, stating the truth for an idiot. His movements were very precise as he set the cup back on the table.
It was not to teach me. I don't think he believes I can be taught. It was to show the others what would happen if they failed.
Very little worth knowing is taught by fear,
Burrich said stubbornly, and more warmly.
It's a poor teacher who tries to instruct by blows and threats. Imagine taming a horse that way, or a dog. Even the most knot-headed dog learns better from an open hand than a stick.
You've struck me before, when trying to teach me something.
Yes, yes I have, but to jolt, or warn, or awaken, not to damage. Never to break a bone, or blind an eye, or cripple a hand, never. Never say to anyone that I've struck you, or any creature in my care that way, for it's not true.
He was indignant that I could even have suggested it.
No, you're right about that.
I tried to think how I could make Burrich understand why I had been punished.
This was different, Burrich. A different kind of learning. A different kind of teaching.
I felt compelled to defend Galen's justice. I tried to explain.
I deserved this, Burrich. The fault was not with his teaching. I failed to learn. I did try, but like Galen, I believe there is a reason the skill is not taught to bastards. There is a taint in me, a fatal weakness.
Horse shit!
No, think on it, Burrich. If you breed a scrub mare to a fine stud, the colt you get is as likely to get the weakness of the mother as the fineness of the father.
The silence was long. Then,
I doubt much that your father would have laid down beside a woman that was a scrub. With some fineness, some sign of spirit or intelligence, he would not. He could not.
I've heard it said that he was tranced by a mountain witch-woman.
For the first time I repeated a tale I'd heard whispered often.
Chivalry was not a man to fall for such magicry, and his son is not some snivelling, weak-spirited fool that lies about and whines that he deserves a beating.
He leaned closer, gently prodded just below my temple. A blast of pain rocked my consciousness.
That's how near you were to losing an eye to this teaching.
His temper was rising, and I kept my mouth closed. He took a quick turn around the room, then spun to face me.
That puppy, he's from Patience's bitch, isn't he?
Yes.
But you haven't. Oh, Fitz, please tell me that it wasn't your using the wit that brought this on you. If he did this to you for that, there's not a word I can say to anyone, or an eye I can meet anywhere in the keep, or the whole kingdom.
No, Burrich, I promise you, this had nothing to do with the pup. It was my failure to learn what I had been taught, my weakness.
Quiet!
He ordered me impatiently.
Your word is enough. I know you well enough to know your promise will always be true. But for the rest, you're making no sense at all. Go back to sleep. I'm going out, but I'll be back soon enough. Get some rest. It's the real healer.
A purpose had settled on Burrich. My words seemed to have finally satisfied him, settled something for him. He dressed quickly, pulling on boots, changing his shirt for a loose one, and putting only a leather jerkin over it. Smithy stood and whined anxiously as Burrich went out, but could not convey his worry to me. Instead, he came to the bedside and scrabbled up, to burrow into the covers beside me and comfort me with his trust. In the bleak despair that settled over me, he was my only light. I closed my eyes and Burrich's herbs sank me into a dreamless sleep. I awoke later that afternoon. A gust of cold air preceded Burrich's entry into the room.
He checked me over, casually prying open my eyes and then running competent hands down my ribs and over my other bruises. He grunted his satisfaction, then changed his torn and muddied shirt for a fresh one. He hummed as he did so, seeming in a fine mood, much at odds with my bruises and depression. It was almost a relief when he left again. Below, I heard him whistling and calling orders to the stable boys. It all sounded so normal and workaday that I longed for it with an intensity that surprised me. I wanted that back, the warm smell of the horses and dogs and straw, the simple tasks, done well and completely, and the good sleep of exhaustion at the end of a day. I longed for it, but the worthlessness that filled me now predicted that even at that I would fail. Galen had often sneered at those who worked such simple jobs about the keep. He had only contempt for the kitchen maids and cooks, derision for the stable boys, and the men-at-arms who guarded us with sword and bow were, in his words, ruffians and dolts, doomed to flail away at the world and control with a sword what they can't master with their minds. So now I was strangely torn. I longed to return to being what Galen had convinced me was contemptible, yet doubt and despair filled me that I could even do so much as that. I was abed for 2 days. A jovial Burrich tended me with banter and good nature that I could not fathom. There was a briskness to his step and a sureness to him that made him seem a much younger man. It added to my dispiritedness that my injuries put him in such fine fettle. But after 2 days of bed rest, Burrich informed me that only so much stillness was good for a man, and it was time I was up and moving if I wished to heal well. And he proceeded to find me many minor chores to perform, none heavy enough to tax my strength, but more than enough to keep me busy, for I had to rest often. I believe that the busyness was what he was after, rather than any exercise for me, for all I had done was to lie in bed and look at the wall and despise myself. Faced with my unrelenting depression, even Smithy had begun to turn aside from his food, yet Smithy remained my only real source of comfort. Following me about the stable was the purest enjoyment he'd ever had. Every scent and sight he relayed to me with an intensity that, despite my bleakness, renewed in me the wonder I had first felt when I'd plunged into Burrich's world. Smithy was savagely possessive of me as well, challenging even Sooty's right to sniff me, and earning himself a snap from Vixen that sent him yipping and cowering to my heels. I begged the next day free for myself and went into Buckkeep Town. The walk took me longer than it had ever taken me before, but Smithy rejoiced in my slow pace, for it gave him time to snuff his way around every clump of grass and tree on the way. I had thought that seeing Molly would lift my spirits and give me some sense of my own life again, but when I got to the chandlery, she was busy at first, filling 3 large orders for outbound ships. I sat by the hearth in the shop. Her father sat opposite me, drinking and glaring at me. Although his illness had weakened him, it had not changed his temperament, and on days when he was well enough to sit up, he was well enough to drink. After a while, I gave up all pretense at conversation, and simply watched him drink and disparage his daughter, as Molly bustled frantically about, trying to be both efficient and hospitable to her customers. The dreary pettiness of it all depressed me. At noon, she told her father she was closing the shop while she went to deliver an order. She gave me a rack of candles to carry, loaded her own arms, and we left, latching the door behind us. Her father's drunken imprecations followed us, but she ignored them. Once outside in the brisk winter wind, I followed Molly as she walked quickly to the back of the shop. Motioning for my silence, she opened the back door and set all that she carried inside. My rack of candles, too, was unloaded there. And then we left. For a bit, we just wandered through the town, talking little. She commented on my bruised face. I said only that I had fallen. The wind was cold and relentless, so the market stalls were near empty, of both customers and vendors. She paid much attention to Smithy.
and he reveled in it. On our walk back, we stopped at a tea shop, and she treated me to mulled wine and made so much of Smithy that he fell over on his back, and all his thoughts turned into wallowing in her affection. I was struck suddenly by how clearly Smithy was aware of her feelings, and yet she did not sense his at all, except on the shallowest level. I quested gently toward her, but found her elusive and drifting today, like a perfume that comes strong and then faint on the same breath of wind. I knew that I could have pushed more insistently against her, but somehow it seemed pointless. An aloneness settled on me, a deadly melancholy that she never had been and never would be any more aware of me than she was of Smithy. So I took her brief words to me as a bird pecks at dry breadcrumbs, and let alone the silence she curtained between us. Soon she said that she could not tarry long, or it would be the worse for her. For if her father no longer had the strength to strike her, he was still capable of smashing his beer mug on the floor, or knocking over the racks of things to show his displeasure at being neglected. She smiled an odd little smile as she told me this, as if it would be less appalling if somehow we thought of his behavior as amusing. I couldn't smile, and she looked away from my face. I helped her with her cloak, and we left, walking uphill and into the wind. And that suddenly seemed a metaphor for my whole life. At her door she shocked me with a hug and a kiss on the corner of my jaw, the embrace so brief that it was almost like being bumped in the market. "New boy," she said, and then, "thank you for understanding." And then she whisked into her shop and shut the door behind her, leaving me chilled and bewildered. She thanked me for understanding her at a time when I had never felt more isolated from her, and everyone else. All the way up to the keep, Smithy kept prattling to himself about all the perfumes he'd smelt on her, and how she had scratched him just where he could never reach in front of his ears, or on the sweet biscuit she'd fed him in the tea shop. It was mid-afternoon when we got back to the stables. I did a few chores and then went back up to Burridge's room, where Smithy and I fell asleep. I awoke to Burridge standing over me, a slight frown on his face. "Up and let's have a look at you," he commanded, and I arose wearily and stood quiet while he went over my injuries with his deft hands. He was pleased with the condition of my hand, and told me that it might go unbandaged now, but to keep the wrapping about my ribs and to come back to have it adjusted each evening. "As for the rest of it, keep it clean and dry, and don't pick at the scabs. If any of it starts to fester, come and see me." He filled a little pot with an unguent that eased sore muscles and gave it to me, by which I deduced that he expected me to leave. I stood, holding the little pot of medicine. A terrible sadness welled up in me, and yet I could find no words to say. Burridge looked at me, scowled, and turned away. "Now stop that," he commanded me angrily.
"What?"
I asked.
"You look at me sometimes with my lord's eyes," he said quietly.
And then, as sharply as before,
"Well, what did you think to do? Hide in the stables the rest of your life? No, you have to go back. You have to go back and hold up your head and eat your meals among the keep folk and sleep in your own room and live your own life. Yes. And go finish those damn lessons in the skill."
His first commands had sounded difficult, but the last I knew was impossible.
"I can't," I said, not believing how stupid he was. "Galen wouldn't let me come back to the group, and even if he did, I'd never catch up on all I've missed. I've already failed at it, Burridge. I failed, and that's done, and I need to find something else to do with myself. I'd like to learn the hawks, please."
The last I heard myself say with some amazement, for in truth, it had never crossed my mind before. Burridge's reply was at least as strange.
"You can't, for the hawks don't like you. You're too warm and you don't mind your own business enough. Now listen to me. You didn't fail, you fool. Galen tried to drive you away. If you don't go back, you'll have let him. You have to go back and you have to learn it. But..."
And here he turned on me, and the anger in his eyes was for me.
You don't have to stand there like a carter's mule while he beats you. You've a birthright to his time and his knowledge. Make him give you what is yours. Don't run away. No one ever gained anything by running away.
He paused, started to say more, and then stopped. I've missed too many lessons. I'll never...
You haven't missed anything,
Burridge said stubbornly. He turned away from me, and I couldn't read his tone as he added,
There have been no lessons since you left. You should be able to pick up just where you left off.
I don't want to go back.
Don't waste my time by arguing with me, he said tightly. Don't dare to try my patience that way. I've told you what you are to do. Do it.
Suddenly, I was 6 years old again, and a man in a kitchen backed up a crowd with a look. I shivered, cowed. Abruptly, it was easier to face Galen than to defy Burridge. Even when he added,
And you'll leave that pup with me until your lessons are done. Being shut up inside your room all day is no life for a dog. His coat will go bad and his muscles won't grow properly. But you'd better be down here each evening to see to both him and Sooty, or you'll answer to me, and I don't give a damn what Galen says about that either.
And so I was dismissed. I conveyed to Smithy that he was to stay with Burridge, and he accepted it with an equanimity that surprised me, as much as it hurt my feelings. Dispirited, I took my pot of unguent and plodded back up to the keep. I took food from the kitchen, for I had no heart to face anyone at table, and went up to my room. It was cold and dark, no fire in the hearth, no candles in the sticks, and the fouled reeds underfoot stank. I fetched candles and wood, set a fire, and while I was waiting for it to take some of the chill off the stone walls and floors, I busied myself with taking up the floor rushes. Then, as Lacey had advised me, I scrubbed the room well with hot water and vinegar. Somehow I got the vinegar that had been flavored with tarragon, and so when I was finished, the room smelled of that herb. Exhausted, I flung myself down on my bed and fell asleep, wondering why I'd never discovered how to open whatever hidden door it was that led to Chade's quarters. But I had no doubt that he would have simply dismissed me, for he was a man of his word, and would not interfere until Galen had finished with me, or until he discovered that I was finished with Galen. The fool's candles awoke me. I was completely disoriented as to time and place until he said,
You've just time to wash and eat, and still be first on the tower top.
He'd brought warm water in a ewer, and warm rolls from the kitchen ovens. I'm not going. It was the first time I'd ever seen the fool look surprised.
Why not?
It's pointless. I can't succeed. I simply haven't the aptitude, and I'm tired of beating my head against the wall. The fool's eyes widened further.
I thought you had been doing well before.
It was my turn to be surprised.
Well, why do you think he mocks me and strikes me as a reward for my success? No, I haven't been able to even understand what it's about. All the others have already surpassed me. Why should I go back so Galen can prove even more thoroughly how right he was?
Something, the fool said carefully, is not right here.
He considered a moment.
Before, I asked you to quit the lessons. You would not. Do you recall that?
I cast my mind back. I'm stubborn sometimes, I admitted.
And if I asked you now to continue, to go up to the tower top and continue to try?
Why have you changed your mind?
Because that which I sought to prevent came to pass. But you survived it. So I seek now to...
His words trailed off.
It is as you said. Why should I speak at all when I cannot speak plainly?
If I said that, I regret it. It is not a thing one should say to a friend. I do not remember it. He smiled faintly.
If you do not remember it, then neither shall I.
He reached and took both of my hands in his,
His grip was oddly cool. A shiver passed over me at his touch.
Would you continue, if I asked it of you, as a friend?
The word sounded so odd from his lips. He spoke it without mockery, carefully, as if the saying of it aloud could shatter the meaning. His colorless eyes held mine. I found I could not say no. So I nodded. Even so, I rose reluctantly. He watched me with an impassive interest as I straightened the clothes I'd slept in, splashed my face, and then tore into the bread he'd brought. "I don't want to go," I told him as I finished the first roll and took up the second. "I don't see what it can accomplish."
"I don't know why he bothers you,"
the fool agreed. The familiar cynicism was back. "Galen? He has to. The king..."
"Barrage.
He just likes bossing me about," I complained, and it sounded childish, even to me. The fool shook his head.
"You haven't a clue, have you?"
"About what?"
"About how the stablemaster dragged Galen from his bed, and from thence to the witness stones. I wasn't there, of course, or I would be able to tell you how Galen cursed and struck at him at first, but the stablemaster paid no attention. He just hunched his shoulders to the man's blows and kept silent. He gripped the skillmaster by the collar, so the man was fair choked and dragged him along. And the soldiers and guards and stable boys followed in a stream that became a torrent of men. If I had been there, I could tell you how no man dared to interfere, for it was as if the stablemaster had become as Burridge once was, an iron-muscled man with a black temper that was like a madness when it came to him. No one then dared to brook that temper, and that day it was as if Burridge was that man again, if he limped still. No one noticed it at all. As for the skillmaster, he flailed and cursed, and then he grew still, and all suspected that he turned what he knew upon his captor. But if he did, it had no effect, save that the stablemaster tightened his grip on the man's neck, and if Galen strove to sway others to his cause, they did not react. Perhaps being choked and dragged was sufficient to break his concentration, or perhaps his skill is not so strong as it was rumored, or perhaps too many remember his mistreatment of them too well to be vulnerable to his wiles. Or perhaps...
Fool, get on with it. What happened? A light sweat cloaked my body, and I shivered, not knowing what I hoped for.
"I wasn't there, of course,"
the fool asserted sweetly.
"But I have heard it said that the dark man dragged the skinny man all the way up to the witness stones. And there, still gripping the skillmaster so he could not speak, he asserted his challenge. They would fight. No weapons, but hands only, just as the skillmaster had assaulted a certain boy the day before. And the stones would witness, if Burridge won, that Galen had had no call to strike the boy, nor had he the right to refuse to teach the boy. And Galen would have refused the challenge and gone to the king himself, except that the dark man had already called the stones to witness. And so they fought, in much the same way that a bull fights a bale of straw when he tosses and stamps and gores it. And when it was done, the stablemaster bent and whispered something to the skillmaster before he and all the others turned and left the man lying there, with the stones witness to his whimpering and bleeding."
"What did he say?" I demanded.
"I wasn't there. I saw and heard nothing of it."
The fool stood and stretched.
"You'll be late if you tarry,"
he pointed out to me, and left. And I left my room, wondering, and climbed the tall tower to the Queen's stripped garden, and was still in time to be the first one there. 16. Lessons. According to the ancient chronicles, skill users were organized in coteries of six. These groups did not usually include any of exceptional royal blood, but were limited to cousins and nephews of the direct line of ascension, or those who showed an aptitude and were judged worthy. One of the most famous, Crossfire's coterie, provides a splendid example of how they functioned. Dedicated to Queen Vision, Crossfire and the others of her coterie had been trained by a skill master called Tactic. The partners in this coterie were mutually chosen by one another, and then received special training from Tactic to bind them into a close unit. Whether scattered across the six duchies to collect or disseminate information, or when massed as a group for the purpose of confounding and demoralizing the enemy, their deeds became legendary. Their final heroism, detailed in the ballad Crossfire's Sacrifice, was the massing of their strength, which they channeled to Queen Vision during the Battle of Besham. Unbeknownst to the exhausted queen, they gave to her more than they could spare themselves, and in the midst of the victory celebration, the coterie was discovered in their tower, drained and dying. Perhaps the people's love of Crossfire's coterie stemmed in part from their all being cripples in one form or another. Blind, lame, hair-lipped, or disfigured by fire were all of the six. Yet in the skill their strength was greater than that of the largest warship, and more important to the defense of the queen. During the peaceful years of King Bounty's reign, the instruction of the skill for the creation of coteries was abandoned. Existing coteries disbanded due to aging, death, or simply a lack of purpose. Instruction in the skill began to be limited to princes only, and for a time it was seen as a rather archaic art. By the time of the Red Ship raids, only King Shrewd and his son Verity were active practitioners of the skill. Shrewd made an effort to locate and recruit former practitioners, but most were aged or no longer proficient. Galen, then skill master for Shrewd, was assigned the task of creating new coteries for the defense of the kingdom. Galen chose to set aside tradition. Coterie memberships were assigned rather than mutually chosen. Galen's methods of teaching were harsh, his training goal that each member would be an unquestioning part of a unit, a tool for the king to use as he needed. This particular aspect was designed solely by Galen, and the first skill coterie he created, he presented to King Shrewd as if it were his gift to give. At least one member of the royal family expressed his abhorrence of the idea. But times were desperate, and King Shrewd could not resist wielding the weapon that had been given into his hand. Such hate! Oh, how they hated me! As each student emerged from the stairwell onto the tower roof to find me there and waiting, each spurned me. I felt their disdain as palpably as if each had dashed cold water against me. By the time the seventh and final student appeared, the cold of their hatred was like a wall around me. But I stood, silent and contained in my accustomed place, and met every eye that was lifted to mine. That, I think, was why no one spoke a word to me. They were forced to take their places around me. They did not speak to each other either. And we waited. The sun came up, and even cleared the wall around the tower, and still Galen had not come. But they kept their places and waited. And so I did likewise. Finally, I heard his halting steps upon the stairs. When he emerged, he blinked in the sun's pale wash, glanced at me, and visibly started. I stood my ground. We looked at one another. He could see the burden of hatred that the others had imposed on me, and it pleased him, as did the bandages I still wore on my temple. But I met his eyes and did not flinch. I dared not. And I became aware of the dismay the others were feeling. Not one could look at him and not see how badly he had been beaten. The witness stones had found him lacking, and all who saw him would know. His gaunt face was a landscape of purples and greens washed over with yellows. His lower lip was split in the middle and cut at the corner of his mouth. He wore a long-sleeved robe that covered his arms, but the flowing looseness of it contrasted so strongly with his usual tightly laced shirts and vests that it was like seeing the man in his nightshirt.
His hands, too, were purple and knobby. But I could not recall that I had seen bruises on Burridge's body. I concluded that he had used them in a vain attempt to shield his face. He still carried his little whip with him, but I doubted he had the capability to swing it effectively. And so we inspected one another. I took no satisfaction in his bruises or his disgrace. I felt something akin to shame for them. I believed so strongly in his invulnerability and superiority that this evidence of his mere humanity left me feeling foolish. That unbalanced his composure. Twice he opened his mouth to speak to me. The third time he turned his back on the class and said,
"Begin your physical limbering. I will observe you to see if you are moving correctly."
The ends of his words were soft, spoken through a painful mouth, and as we dutifully stretched and swayed and bowed in unison, he crabbed awkwardly about the tower garden. He tried not to lean on the wall or to rest too often. Gone was the slap, slap, slap of the whip against his thigh that had formerly orchestrated our efforts. Instead, he gripped it as if afraid he might drop it. For my part, I was grateful that Burridge had made me get up and move. My bound ribs didn't permit me the full flexibility of motion that Galen had formerly commanded from us, but I made an honest attempt at it. He offered us nothing new that day, only going over what we had already learned, and the lessons came to an early end before the sun was even down.
"You have done well," he said lamely. "You have earned these 3 hours, for I am pleased you have continued to study in my absence."
Before dismissing us, he called each of us before him for a brief touch of the skill. The others left reluctantly, with many a backward glance, curious as to how he would deal with me. As the numbers of my fellow students dwindled, I braced myself for a solitary confrontation. But even that was a disappointment. He called me before him, and I came, as silent and outwardly respectful as the others. I stood before him as they had, and he made a few brief passes of his hands before my face and over my head. Then he said in a cold voice,
"You shield too well. You must learn to relax your guard over your thoughts if you are either to send them forth or to receive those of others. Go."
And I left, as the others had, but regretfully. Privately, I wondered if he had made a real attempt to use the skill on me. I had felt no brush of it. I descended the stairs, aching and bitter, wondering why I was trying. I went to my room and then to the stables. I gave Sooty a cursory brushing while Smithy watched. Still, I felt restless and dissatisfied. I knew I should rest, that I would regret it if I did not.
"Stonewalk?"
Smithy suggested, and I agreed to take him into town. He galloped and sniffed circles around me as I made my way down from the keep. It was a blustery afternoon after a calm morning. A storm was building offshore, but the wind was unseasonably warm, and I felt the fresh air clearing my head, and the steady rhythm of walking soothed and stretched the muscles that Galen's exercises had left bunched and aching. Smithy's sensory prattle grounded me firmly in the immediate world, so that I could not dwell on my frustrations. I told myself it was Smithy who led us so directly to Molly's shop. Puppy-like, he had returned to where he had been welcomed before. Molly's father kept to his bed that day, and the shop was fairly quiet. A single customer lingered, talking to Molly. Molly introduced him to me as Jade. He was a mate off some Seal Bay trading vessel, not quite 20, and he spoke to me as if I were 10, smiling past me at Molly the whole time. He was full of tales of red ships and sea storms. He had a red stone earring in one ear and a new beard curled along his jaw. He took far too long to select candles and a new brass lamp. But he finally left.
"Close the store for a bit,"
I urged Molly.
"Let's go down to the beach. The wind is lovely today."
She shook her head regretfully.
I'm behind in my work. I should dip tapers all this afternoon if I have no customers, and if I do have customers, I should be here.
I felt unreasonably disappointed. I quested toward her, and discovered how much she actually wished to go.
There's not that much daylight left, I said persuasively. You can always dip tapers this evening, and your customers will come back tomorrow if they find you closed today.
She cocked her head, looked thoughtful, and abruptly set aside the wicking she held.
You're right, you know. The fresh air will do me good.
And she took up her cloak with an alacrity that delighted Smithy and surprised me. We closed up the shop and left. Molly set her usual brisk pace. Smithy frolicked about her, delighted. We talked in a cursory way. The wind put roses in her cheeks, and her eyes seemed brighter in the cold. And I thought she looked at me more often and more pensively than she usually did. The town was quiet, and the market all but deserted. We went to the beach and walked sedately where we had raced and shrieked but a few years before. She asked me if I had learned to light a lantern before going down steps at night, and that mystified me, until I remembered that I had explained my injuries as a fall down a dark staircase. She asked me if the schoolteacher and the horsemaster were still at odds, and by this I discerned that Burrich and Galen's challenges at the witness stones had become something of a local legend already. I assured her that peace had been restored. We spent some little time gathering a certain kind of seaweed that she wanted to flavor her chowder that evening. Then, for I was winded, we sat in the lee of some rocks and watched Smithy make numerous attempts to clear the beach of all gulls.
"So, I hear Prince Verity is to wed," she began conversationally.
"What?" I asked, amazed. She laughed heartily.
"New boy, I have never met anyone so immune to gossip as you seem to be. How can you live right up there in the keep and know nothing of that which is the common talk of the town? Verity has agreed to take a bride to assure the succession, but the story in town is that he is too busy to do his courting himself, so Regal will find him a lady."
"Oh, no." My dismay was honest. I was picturing big, bluff Verity paired with one of Regal's sugar crystal women. Whenever there was a festival of any kind in the keep, Spring's Edge or Winter Heart or Harvest Day, here they came, from Chalced and Farrow and Bairns, in carriages or on richly caparisoned palfreys, or riding in litters. They wore gowns like butterflies' wings, and ate as daintily as sparrows, and seemed to flutter about and perch always in Regal's vicinity. And he would sit in their midst, in his own silk and velvet hues, and preen while their musical voices tinkled around him, and their fans and fancywork trembled in their fingers. Prince catchers, I've heard them called, noble women who displayed themselves like goods in a store window in the hopes of wedding one of the royals. Their behavior was not improper, not quite, but to me it seemed desperate, and Regal, cruel as he smiled first on this one, and then danced all evening with that one, only to rise to a late breakfast and walk yet another through the gardens. They were Regal's worshippers. I tried to picture one on Verity's arm as he stood watching the dancers at a ball, or quietly weaving in his study, while Verity pondered and sketched at the maps he so loved. No garden strolls. Verity took his walks along the docks and through the crops, stopping often to talk to the seafolk and farmers behind their ploughs. Dainty slippers and embroidered skirts would surely not follow him there. Molly slipped a penny into my hand.
"What's this for?"
"To pay for whatever you've been thinking so hard, that you've been sitting on the edge of my skirt while I've twice asked you to lift up.
I don't think you've heard a word I've said."
I sighed. "Verity and Regal are so different. I cannot imagine one choosing a wife for the other." Molly looked puzzled.
"Regal will choose someone who is beautiful and wealthy and of good blood. She'll be able to dance and sing and play the chimes. She'll dress beautifully and have jewels in her hair at the breakfast table, and always smell of the flowers that grow in the rain wilds. And Verity will not be glad of such a woman."
The confusion on Molly's face was as if I were insisting the sea was soup.
Verity deserves a companion, not an ornament to wear on his sleeve.
I protested in disdain.
Were I Verity? I'd want a woman who could do things, not just select her jewelry or plait her own hair. She should be able to sew a shirt or tend her own garden, and have something special she can do that is all her own, like scroll work or herbery.
New boy, the like of that is not for fine ladies,
Molly chided me.
They are meant to be pretty and ornamental, and they are rich. It isn't for them to have to do such work.
Of course it is. Look at Lady Patience and her woman, Lacey. They are always about and doing things. Their apartments are a jungle of the lady's plants, and the cuffs of her gowns are sometimes a bit sticky from her paper-making, or she will have bits of leaves in her hair from her herbery work. But she is still just as beautiful. And prettiness is not all that important in a woman. I've watched Lacey's hands making one of the keep children a fishnet from a bit of jute string. Quick and clever as any webman's fingers down on the dock are her fingers. Now that's a pretty thing that has nothing to do with her face. And Hod, who teaches weapons? She loves her silverwork and graving. She made a dagger for her father's birthday with a grip like a leaping stag, and yet done so cleverly that it's a comfort in her hand, with not a jag or edge to catch on anything. Now that's a bit of beauty that will live on long after her hair grays or her cheeks wrinkle. Some day her grandchildren will look at that work and think, what a clever woman she was.
Do you think so, really?
Certainly. I shifted, suddenly aware of how close Molly was to me. I shifted, yet did not really move farther away. Down the beach, Smithy made another foray into a flock of gulls. His tongue was hanging nearly to his knees, but he was still galloping.
But if noble ladies do all those things, they'll ruin their hands with the work, and the wind will dry their hair and tan their faces. Surely Verity doesn't deserve a woman who looks like a deckhand.
Surely he does. Far more than he deserves a woman who looks like a fat red carp kept in a bowl. Molly giggled.
Someone to ride beside him of a morning when he takes Hunter out for a gallop, or someone who can look at a section of map he's just finished and actually understand just how fine a piece of work it is.
That's what Verity deserves.
I've never ridden a horse, Molly objected suddenly. And I know few letters.
I looked at her curiously, wondering why she seemed so suddenly downcast.
What matter is it? You're clever enough to learn anything. Look at all you've taught yourself about candles and herbs. Don't tell me that came from your father. Sometimes when I come by the shop, your hair and dress smell all of fresh herbs, and I can tell you've been experimenting to get new perfumes for the candles. If you wanted to read or write more, you could learn. As for riding, you'd be a natural. You've balance and strength. Look at how you climb the rocks on the cliffs. And animals take to you. You fair one Smithy's heart away from me.
Fah!
She gave me a nudge with her shoulder. You talk as if some lord should come riding down from the keep and carry me off.
I thought of August with his stuffy manners, or Regal simpering at her.
Ida forbid. You'd be wasted on them. They wouldn't have the wit to understand you, or the heart to appreciate you.
Molly looked down at her work-worn hands.
Who would, then?
She asked softly. Boys are fools. The conversation had grown and twined around us.